In 2022, rent increases peaked at about 15%.
That's insane. Wow.
Yeah, and that's an annual increase. And then so if they're increasing still around 2% by the end of 2023, you know, that's on top of that really high increase. So they just continue to go up.
Welcome back to Core Conversations, a CoreLogic podcast, where we tour the property market to investigate how economics, climate change, governmental policies, and technology affect everyday life. I am your host, May Claire Bolton-Smith, and I'm just as curious as you are about everything that happens in our industry. If you follow the housing market, you've probably heard of the build-to-rent communities that have sprung up in subdivisions across the United States. These communities have raised many questions, including whether the U.S. is moving toward becoming a society of renters. However, the emergence of this phenomenon is due to complex factors in the market. So one major factor is the housing market supply crisis that we've talked about frequently on this podcast. According to Fannie Mae, the shortage of housing units in 2022 was 4.4 million. Part of this is due to mortgage rates doubling and keeping people in their homes. Research from Fannie Mae showed that in August of 2023, the number of existing homes for sale was about 40% below sales in August of 2019. Then there's the question of affordability, both in terms of home sale prices and rental prices. But those aren't the only two pieces of this complex puzzle. So to talk about this trend and the rental economy across the country, we have one of our favorite guests back with us today, Molly Basil, Principal Economist from our Office of the Chief Economist. Molly, welcome back to Core Conversations.
Oh, May Claire, it's great to be here. This is one of my favorite things to do each quarter, I guess we do this.
Yeah, we've done quite a few of them, and don't tell any of our other guests. You're my favorite.
So I think they're going to hear that now. So
it's all good. Everyone's my favorite, but I love doing this with you.
Before we get back into the state of the U.S. rental economy, I wanted to remind our listeners that we want to help you keep pace with the property market. To make it easy, we curate the latest insight and analysis for you on our social media, where you can find us using the handle at CoreLogic on Facebook and LinkedIn, or at CoreLogic Inc. on X, formerly known as Twitter, and Instagram. But now, let's get back to Mayclair and Molly.
So let's just jump right into it. So there's an elephant in the room here, affordability. It's a topic we've talked about many times before. At the end of last season, Chief Economist Selma Hepp came on and we talked about it being a continuing concern. But the latest research that we did here at CoreLogic at the end of 2023 was that the U.S. rental market was one of the least affordable rental markets in history. So for the first time in decades, the rent-to-income ratio has reached 40% at the height of U.S. inflation. So how did we get here?
Yeah, that is a great question. So there have been years of increases in rents, and that really stems from, first of all, the low supply of rentals. Just like there's a low supply of for sale housing, there's a low supply of rentals.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, and we also have an increased demand from new households. And why do we have a lot of new households? Well, we have a lot of our population is in that age where they form households, but we also have one of the strongest job markets on record. Yeah. So, you know, if the economy is strong and people are going to be forming households. So that's one of the reasons rents have been going up. So not only the newly formed households are creating demand, but you also have some spillover from that for sale market you talked about that was so constrained.
Yeah.
And that's all making it much more expensive to buy. Renters are delaying home ownership and they're keeping that pressure on rents. So it's just, you know, it's there's a for sale housing market, a rental housing market, but you can really think of it as just the overall housing market going up.
Yeah. Wow. I know we've talked about this over the last probably 18 months or so, or the last 2 years, that we've really just seen rentals skyrocketing. And I know there's different areas of the country that are, you know, worse than others. But how fast are in this moment in time, at the beginning of 2024, how fast are rental prices going up, or are they still going up?
Yeah, so rents are going up at the end of 2023, around 2% year to year.
Okay.
So, you know, that doesn't sound like a lot.
Doesn't sound too bad.
Yeah, but they are still going up. Mm-hmm. And in 2022.
And they're going up from something that was higher historically,
exactly,
right?
So, exactly. Okay. You took the words right out of my mouth. In 2022, rent increases peaked at about 15%.
That's insane. Wow.
Yeah. And that's an annual increase. Yeah. And then, so if they're increasing still around 2% by the end of 2023, you know, that's on top of that really high increase. So they just continue to go up. You know, even though, you know, you'll look and say, oh, well, it's the smallest increase since, you know, in 3 or 4 years. Well, you know, that's after years and years of increases.
Yeah. Overall, if we look at kind of that overall increase since 2020, since the pandemic, like what's the total? Like how much on average are things have things gone up?
Yes. Over 3.5 years, up over 30%. So
that is crazy.
Yes,
that is crazy.
Wow. Exactly.
Wow. People's income hasn't gone up over 30% in the last 3 years.
No, it has not gone up over 30%. It's certainly not kept up. And that's when you referenced that study earlier in the podcast here about one of the least affordable rental markets on record. Yeah. And that's because rents have gone up so much and incomes haven't really kept up.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The other thing I think of too is because mortgage rates have gone up so much. And maybe if people are renting out a home that they have a mortgage on, they have to charge more for a rent as well, too. Like I kind of look at, you know, we recently bought this house. You and I've chatted about this before, too. And, you know, what our mortgage is compared to what it would have been 2 years ago is significantly higher. And if we, you know, ever chose to rent out this property, we couldn't. I don't think anybody would want to pay for it, what we would have to charge to make money. So I think if people are in that circumstance of maybe they're buying an investment property and something they want to rent, they either have to have a really high rental value or it's not even an option for them to make an investment.
Yeah, that's a good point. So you have what we might term, you know, accidental investors. So those people who don't necessarily want to sell their current property, but they want to buy a new one.
Yeah.
And then they take out a mortgage at a pretty high rate and then they need to charge high rents. So it's all, you know, all related.
Are you interested in hearing more about investors? Tune in to episode 78 to listen to May Claire and the economist Tom Malone talk about global investor trends. The episode aired on November 8th, 2023. It's called Why U.S. Property Retains Its Value Compared to Other Global Markets. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, if we go back to that 30-ish, over 30% increase in the last 3-ish years. Mm-hmm, how does that compare if we look at like a long-term average over the last 20 or 30 years?
Yeah. So we had a period of time in the rental market as roughly about 10 years before the pandemic when rent growth was consistently around 2-4% annually.
Okay.
So, you know, when I'm talking about, you know, he slowed down to the 2%, rate, that's really kind of more like the average long-term rate for rent increases. So, you know, seeing rent increases come down to around 2% is really, I think, kind of encouraging that we've come back to that trend.
You know, something that particular comment just triggered a thought, and I don't know if we have any data on this, but I know there's this topic of rent control, which sometimes comes up, and like people are locked in and, you know, can't have their property increase in value too much. Do we have any research or any data in if rent controlled properties have seen this kind of growth as well, or if that is something, have we not looked into that?
Yeah, I think just with the way rent control works, I don't think they are able to increase the rent at all. But what will happen is other rents in the area will make up for that. So if, say, an investor has more than one property and one is rent controlled, they may need to increase the other rents on other properties to make up
to kind of
that.
Make up to it. Yeah,
exactly.
Okay, going back to this affordability topic, because it's a huge one. Regionally, though, it's not the same across the country. Like there definitely are certain cities or certain metros that have had much more significant increases. I think when we talked to Selma, she called out Miami as being one that was really, really huge.
Miami is just, it's really incredible what happened there. Rents increased from 2020, rents increased around 50% through the end
of 2023. That's crazy.
Yeah, that's a crazy increase. It's sort of like what we see across the country with home prices as well. You have people coming into the area from maybe New York who have pretty high salaries moving to Miami and bringing those high salaries with them. And you know, increasing the rents along with, you know, the demand is in helping increase the rents.
Yeah.
But then what that really happens is those residents that were already there do become priced out of their rentals.
Yeah. You know, the other thing that I just kind of triggers a thought as we're talking is I think kind of historically when people talked about renters, they thought apartments, apartment buildings. But I know a huge part of the rental markets are single family homes and townhouses. And what's the percentage of people do we know in terms of like those multifamily complexes versus a single family home?
Yeah. So our CoreLogic index that I referenced earlier, that is for single family homes. So that those are detached houses, condos, townhouses. Anything like that. And those are about 50% of the rental market. So I think people think, the rental market's mostly these multifamily properties. The single family are about 50% of the rental market.
That's huge. That is really huge. It's much higher than I anticipated it being.
Yeah. It is kind of, it's, I think when I first looked at that years ago, I was like, wow.
I think it's because when we think renters, we think apartment buildings, we think multifamily complexes.
There is all sorts of stuff, you know.
Yeah. So if it's 50%, you know, one thing that you and I've talked about this before, Selma and I have talked about it as well, is the demand. There's not a lot of properties on the market. But Selma did mention that there's a kind of an influx of new builds happening right now. Is kind of the lack of properties on the market contributing to this high percentage increase? Is that correlated?
So there's a lot going on with new builds. And one thing is building has been really stagnant in the U.S. for really since the Great Recession. And that goes back to, overbuilding back then, and then a lot of builders going out of business and, not keeping up. And so now with the demand and the lack of resale properties on the market, builders are, finding it's a good time to build.
Yeah.
Another thing is, we talked about this with my rate buy down podcast.
Yeah.
Builders are able to, they provide their own financing a lot of times, and they're able to buy down rates. So, if I were to buy a resale property, I need to go to the bank and I'd end up with a 8% mortgage rate or something. I don't know where we'll be when this comes out, but a builder could buy down that rate, and self-finance that. They don't need to go to a bank for that.
That's a really good point.
That makes a new build really popular for buyers.
Throughout this conversation, Mayclair references an episode that she did with Selma Hepp. That episode is the final episode of the 2023 season. It aired in two parts on November 29th and December 6th. The first episode is called 2023 Economic Look Back, A Tale of Two Housing Markets. The second episode is called What is the 2024 Economic Outlook for the Property Industry? You can find these anywhere you get your podcast, and there's a link in the show notes.
One thing I've heard of is this concept of build to rent. So is that kind of related to that? Is that they're, builders are building properties to make them rental properties?
Yeah. So build to rent, I just find fascinating because it really fills this market. It's, they're always going to have renters around, even if it's not a great time to buy because of interest rates or, prices are really high.
Some people just prefer it.
That they'll be in the rental market. And so it's what you might call kind of like an evergreen kind of a concept. So a builder who may be building a new community for sale will then maybe shift to building community, maybe not entirely for rent or partially for rent. So there's no one cookie cutter model for that.
Yeah. I remember when we were looking at this for this house, we encountered some new builds that there were something like, they were intending for 50% of the homes to be for rent and the other ones were meant to be for sale. So I think that was just part of their strategy, their business strategy.
Yeah. And you have, young, people who don't want to take care of a house or they want some new construction, but they can't afford to buy it. And you have also students. You have retirees who don't want to take care of a yard. So
the perennial, those are the ones that will always be renters,
that's
students.
Right.
And
that's right. And it's like they operate like a multifamily building, but they look like a, you know, like a regular single family community.
Yeah, absolutely. I think also when people think rentals, they think starter homes or things for students, or are, is that primarily what these build to rent are, or are they trending more towards luxury homes as well?
Yeah. So with the build for rent, I think it's just not, like I said, it's not really like a cookie cutter model, but the sweet spot is really like a 2,500 square foot home. So three to
four
bedrooms.
That's a big house.
So for a rental, that's pretty big. I know where my house I live in isn't 2,500 square feet, but that, you know, is a decent sized house. So,
and
because they're new, and they have a lot of the newer amenities, they do kind of come at a premium. So I think that'd be more your premium rental market. But, you know, it does fill a hole, and it fills, you know, it adds to that supply. When if you have a shortage of rental supply, you're adding to that supply of rental houses. So that should ease up the any supply pressures you're seeing on prices.
Sure. Yeah.
And then the other thing that fascinates me with built to rent is these don't necessarily always need to be rentals forever and ever. Right?
Sure. Yeah.
If there comes a time when the owner of the build for rent just wants to sell everything, they've got a community of single family homes they can sell.
Yeah. That's a really good point.
You know, in the future, sometime in the future could add to the for sale housing.
Yeah. Wow. Interesting. I think I read somewhere that it wasn't just, you know, private venture capitalists or that were building these build to rent, but also some of the largest banks were also joining in on that. Is that true?
Yeah. So build for rent has really increased over the past probably five years. It used to be a pretty small market, and it's just been increasing year after year. It's still a pretty small portion of the rental market, but it has been growing. So all sorts of investors are getting into that.
Yeah. Is it big enough or growing enough to make a dent in the economy or make kind of any impact in the current economy?
Well, I think when you look at the build for rent, they're really targeted in certain parts of the country. So it could make an impact on local economies, but maybe not the entire U.S. Yeah.
It's that time again. Grab a cup of coffee or your favorite beverage. We're going to do the numbers in the housing market. Here's what you need to know. CoreLogic forecasts home prices to increase by 2.8% on a year-over-year basis from December 2023 to December 2024. A healthy job market continues to drive mortgage performance and housing demand. In January 2024, the country added 353,000 new jobs, according to February data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. These economic and housing market dynamics are happening while the inventory of homes for sale remains slim. Miami once again posted the highest year-over-year home price gains at 10.7%. Prices in San Diego, Chicago, Boston, and Washington, D.C. rose 8.1%, 6.8%, 6.7%, and 6.2% respectively. Meanwhile, Spokane Valley, Washington is at a very high risk of decline in home prices over the next 12 months. And that's The Sip. See you next time.
So, okay, that's really interesting. And I guess on the other hand, if we flip this and we talk a lot about homeowners and homeownership and purchasing homes, has that, because of this kind of influx and growth of the build to rent and others, is that correlating at all with the slow homeownership rates? So maybe not have as many people. Is that simply because of high interest rates, or is it correlated?
Yeah, I think the slowdown in home sales really has a lot to do with high interest rates.
Yeah.
And it has the high interest rates were coming on top of really high home price increases.
Yeah.
So you had, when interest rates were low, even with the, prices went up around 40% over the past few years, with interest rates down around 3%, it really was still pretty affordable month to month to make your payments. But once interest rates, doubled or more.
Skyrocketed.
Yeah, that's what really put the brakes on home sales.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. I guess, one thing we've talked about, I think Selma and I talked about this at the end of the year, was the data is showing a lot of new first-time homebuyers. So is it, do we think, I mean, part of it, I think Selma and I talked about as well, too, is they don't have anything to compare it to. Like, they don't know what a 2.5% interest rate is because
That's
they never
right.
had
yeah.
it, right? So they kind of are coming into this with not knowing how good it could have been. Is it, do we think it's these, you know, skyrocketing rent prices that have driven them to be like, let me just buy a home and sure, 8% interest or 7% interest is okay. That's just what it is. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. You're not giving up any kind of low mortgage rate, first time home buyer. So when you look at it, the median rate of outstanding mortgages, so everybody that has a mortgage right now, their median rate is 3.5%. So that's weighted way towards the people that bought a few years ago or more. So if you're an owner with a 3 to 3.5% mortgage rate, do you really want to buy a new, different house and take on an 8% mortgage? I mean,
you're asking somebody who did it. Was it a smart decision and overall in terms of finances? No, not really. People would not be their top choice of things to do.
So if you're moving to a new city, right?
Yeah.
That certainly makes sense. I mean, it could all, but if you just maybe want to trade up, get a slightly bigger house, it's really hard to stomach that. So that's
for sure.
A lot of what's driving that kind of increase in the share in first time home buyers. So, the number of first time home buyers, maybe not going up a lot, but the share is going up a lot because, the repeat buyers, share is going way down.
It's down so much. Yeah, no, that totally makes sense.
Before we end this episode, let's take a break and talk about what's happening in the world of natural disasters. CoreLogic's Hazard HQ Command Central reports on natural catastrophes and extreme weather events across the world. A link to their coverage is in the show notes. 2024 started on unsteady footing when a magnitude 7.5 earthquake rocked Japan's Noto Peninsula, causing widespread damage. Insured loss estimates are between $1 billion and $5 billion. Then the windstorms rolled in. January brought Winter Storm Finn to the southeastern U.S. CoreLogic estimated that 26,617 single and multifamily homes were potentially impacted by tornadic winds in Florida, southeastern Alabama, and southwestern Georgia. Only days later, Storm Ingunn slammed into Norway's west coast, causing widespread disruption to transportation infrastructure across Norway. The affected areas were sparsely populated and had limited commercial activity, so insured loss from this event is not expected to be high. In California, flooding from atmospheric rivers returned for the second year in a row. Officials declared a state of emergency in 8 California counties with evacuations in some areas. Hundreds of thousands of homes in California were at considerable risk of life-threatening flooding. At the time of this recording, the storms were still ongoing.
Okay, one last question is advantages of being a renter versus a homeowner. I think historically everybody was always saying, it's better to be a homeowner because you're building equity and you're building this and you're building that. And a renter is, a lot of people think of it as your money's just going out the door. The stability of a 30-year fixed mortgage, like even if it's a high mortgage rate, if the rental rates are going to continue to increase at 2% now, maybe they go up to 5 or 10% again, like you don't really know what's going to happen.
You really
so
can't
is there the opportunity?
Right.
You can't control it versus a 30-year fixed. Even if you're locked in at 7 or 8%, you know what it's going to be.
Right. And the thing you don't have with a rental is, when mortgage rates drop, as they're expected to do in the next year or so, you can't refi that rental rate. I doubt a year from now that mortgage rates will be at 8%. So there'll be a lot of refinancing and people really bring down their monthly costs quite a bit with owning.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, Molly. This is number one of Q1. We're going to have you back 3 more times this year. So thank you for
joining. I'm looking forward to it. This, like I said, is one of my favorite things I do each quarter.
Yeah, me too. So thank you so much for joining us again today on Core Conversations, the CoreLogic podcast.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. And thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed our latest episode. Please remember to leave us a review and let us know your thoughts and subscribe wherever you get your podcast to be notified when new episodes are released. And thanks to the team for helping bring this podcast to life. Producer Jesse Devenins, editor and sound engineer Romeo Roman, our fax guru Erica Stanley, and social media duo Sarah Buck and Michaela Brooks. Tune in next time for another Core Conversation.
You You still there? Well, thanks for sticking around. Are you curious to know a little bit more about our guest today? Well, Molly Basil is an economist at CoreLogic. She is responsible for analyzing and forecasting housing and mortgage market trends. She has deep expertise in mortgage market analysis, model development, and risk analysis in the housing finance industry. She regularly contributes to the CoreLogic Intelligence blog, where you can read her work at CoreLogic.com/intelligence.